First question. Yes.
It seems that part of our standing up and not being afraid requires that we take our money and channel it, because in our pseudo-capitalistic system, that's what's respected. So doesn't it make sense that if we want to focus on the prison industrial complex and educative systems, that we should find the people who are bankrolling it and take our money from them? Yeah. Do the research to find out who they are, where they meet, where they get their resources from, so that we can finally neutralize them and stop all of this?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Did you all hear that very important question in the back? You heard it. Okay, that's good. Because, I mean, one, let me say two things. That there's a new book that great Angela Davis is putting out on prisons. It'll be out in a few months. That zeroes in on these kinds of issues to keep track of the money flow and so forth. And then the question becomes, well, which particular organizations will make this a priority? Now, we're going to put pressure on organizations to make this a priority so that it becomes a public issue. People have public knowledge of the way in which people are making money off the increase of prison, so it's in their economic interest to have more folk arrested in order to then warehouse them, use their cheap labor, absolutely. So it's a question of trying to make it more public.
And the educative systems focus in on that when you take large segments of children that are only supposed to be prepared to be trained, then all the things that support those systems also are consistent with that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons. Let me just say this very briefly, because I don't want to use this platform to proselytize, though. But it's one of the reasons why I work so closely with Brother Al Sharpton in the presidential campaign. Because, see, when you have a public debate, when you run a primary, you have a public debate. And so many American people of all colors are apathetic. They're indifferent. They don't listen to what's going on. But every once in a while, they get your attention. And then to have Brother Sharpton there, great intelligence. A lot of people mistake his brain for his haircut now. Don't do that. Don't do that. He's a brilliant brother. He can wear the hair any way he wants. For him in public, for the world to see, in those debates, talking about the prison industrial complex, where the candidates stand, then you get various articles written in the newspaper about the prison industrial complex. People say, oh my God, I didn't know this was going on. Yeah, it's been going on for a long time. Black families, brown families, poor families been dealing with this for a long time. Yes, you didn't know about this yet? Let's talk about this. Different newspapers, New York, California, so forth and so on. And then you have your progressives already ready to provide a broader framework. So your question is a crucial one. And I think already there's a movement in this regard.
Second question, down there. Yes.
Yeah, the question had to do was how pervasive is Leo Strauss, who was a scholar in political philosophy, political theory. He wrote books on Aristophanes, wrote books on Hobbes and a host of others, and has a number of conservative disciples. Now, of course, like any other scholar, he's actually got progressive disciples. He's got some centrists, though most of his disciples are conservative. So he's a complex figure, and he's not to be reduced simply to his disciples, as is often the case, as we know, you know. But they are highly influential in public policy circles. They're not that influential in the academic discourses that are distant from public policy. So right now, when you have those figures in the White House, State Department, and other places who view themselves as Straussians, they have a disproportionate amount of influence. And the question then becomes, which particular elements of Leo Strauss are being appropriated by these public policy people, these officials, and what are the ways in which they're using it to pursue their imperial aims? You know, you got new imperialists there who are now in the driver's seat. Various attempts to try to cut back on social services, various attempts to push labor to their backs to the wall, act as if their interests are special interests. That's the vast majority of people in the society. Isn't it interesting that you have a business page but not a labor page in the newspaper?
Whoa.
How you gonna have a business page when the small group of folk, especially big business, and so much of the views in the newspaper from the vantage point of big business, Well, what about the vast majority of people? Where is the labor page? No, labor is just an extension of big business's quest for profit. Why does that have to be the case? You see, that's the kind of questioning that's very important, and you don't get that out of so many of the Straussians who appropriate him in a conservative manner.
Next question. Yes, I see a red sweat, black, yes.
Yes, I don't know enough people to know what practical measures we can take to keep our young people away from the prison judgment context and move them towards to higher levels of education like they
are. Yeah, I appreciate that question, though, very much so. One thing is we got to produce more folk like yourself, which is to say, more folk who are raising these kind of questions, concerned enough to try to keep a distance from that track that runs into the prison industrial complex. Right now, we do have, I mean, part of the problem is this, you see, in a market culture that is obsessed with buying and selling, the ultimate logic is the gangsterization of culture.
Wow.
See, that's in part why gangster rap emerges at the moment that it does. Because they begin to see that there's so many gangsters in high and influential places, and they think that's the way the game is played. And if that's the way the game is played, the aim is to be a better gangster. Now, that's actually logical. It may not be moral, but it's logical. You know, somebody's gangsterizing you and you being defeated, and you think by being a better gangster that you can win, then you begin to specialize in gangster activity. Well, that's what a lot of the young brothers have been engaged in over the last 40 years or so. And it's reflected in their music, you see. But the point is they're imitating what they see on the broader scale. They look in the White House and see gangsters, Wall Street see gangsters. Religious institutions see gangsters, City Hall see gangsters, State House see gangsters. They say, oh, that's the way it is. Everybody concerned with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. That's what it's really all about, to let me be a better gangster. Well, that's not moral, but that's practical in terms of survival. And as I was saying before, we have ways of trying to convince young folk that it's a dead end anyway. See what I mean? Yet it's difficult to, because we got to communicate with them. But you can't communicate with folk who feel as if you don't care about them. I mean, we've got the largest generation gap in the history of Black America ever. Ever. Never in the history of Black people have so many older folk disrespected younger folk, and younger folk disrespected older folk. And if you don't have communication, how are you going to bequeath a tradition? It's even in the music. You know, you got all these young, talented young folk can't even play instruments. I say, listen to Lakeside. They playing their instruments. Listen to Ohio Players. They may look a little strange to you. They can play their instruments, man. They don't need the machines. You see what I mean? How do you transmit that tradition? Curtis Mayfield is in his wheelchair trying to play his guitar. With Brother Entombe, y'all know Brother Entombe, my dear brother. Towering figure. Let's give him a hand, actually. He's such a towering figure. And he was so kind to have Curtis Mayfield, actually, playing in New York. And he was just talking about his effort to play. And if young folk could see that, because it's not just to make the music, it's to do what? To uplift and elevate the souls of people.
Brother in the blue sweater, right in front of us.
Yes.
I want to ask this question in general to you, Dr. West.
Yes.
Order.
Sure.
Are you all aware of the fact that a lot of African American men, particularly young, are coming out of Caldwell Prison not too far from here, bragging about the fact that they're going to infect every black woman with AIDS? They are HIV positive as well as the full-blown AIDS. Are you all aware of that?
Just stand.
Definitely, because the question raised a very important one. It has to do with individual responsibility, personal culpability. It has to do with people who are willing to dehumanize other people, humiliate other people, in a certain sense, maybe even murder other people, especially people who disproportionately look like you. And if you reach the point where your self-value is so limited that you ascribe so little significance to yourself.
Yes, yes.
That's what nihilism is. That's what hopelessness is. That's what meaninglessness is. And you then live a life in which feeling dehumanized, you dehumanize others. In this particular case, in this ugly and vicious example of infecting not just women, because it's infecting men too. You know, you got it's a bisexual thing, right? Across the board. And that's a question of any response. But then the question becomes, well, it's going to be up to the men and the women who are interacting with them to protect themselves, because they may be sleeping with nihilists like that. So that's the other side of the individual responsibility too. You're absolutely right. But I appreciate the question though, man.
Next question. Yes.
During the 1960s, a lot of black men were unjustly arrested, and some of them are languishing in prison and have been there for 20 or 30 years. Nobody ever speaks about these men who are buried down these prisons. One particular guy, a cold, who was arrested on the New Jersey Turnpike for the Sada Shakur. Why isn't anybody speaking about these political prisoners? And the fact that they don't even want to say what men in America has political prisoners.
Right. The question is, why aren't people addressing the question of black political prisoners?
No, it's a very important question, though. I mean, many of us have been involved much more with Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal than the figure you mentioned. But we've been trying to make that public. The same was true with Brother Johnny Cochran and the time that we spent focusing on Brother Geronimo Pratt, who's now changed his name as No Geronimo Pratt at that time. But your question is a very important one. It also forces us to come to terms with those who were willing to make such great sacrifice 30, 40 years ago, and then find themselves overlooked or ignored 40 years later, and then wonder, why is it that a people can have such short memory and forget so quickly, you see? And so I think your question forces us to remember. So when I talk about this tradition of struggle, I'm talking about many of those particular persons who paid a serious price in this regard, you see. But a lot of it also has to do with the kind of weaponry you deploy. You see, as you know, in the 1960s, there were intense political and ideological differences as to how you struggle for freedom. Some folk were willing to pick up the gun.
Yes.
You see, well, if you pick up the gun, there's other guns been picked up. Mm-hmm. So you got a confrontation.
Yes.
Huey Newton, for me, in the 1960s, when he looked the policeman straight in the eye and looked the barrel of a gun straight in the eye and said, shoot, because I believe in the power of the people.
Yes,
that's deep love and courage.
Yes,
there's no doubt about it. But at the same time, you say, well, Brother Hewitt,
yes,
is that the strategy for every brother you know? Because the FBI will have some of your black brothers paid in your organization.
Yes.
And have them shoot you in the back while you're standing. You gotta be very careful who you're dealing with here. That's one of the reasons why Martin was always saying, well, you know, once you pick up these weapons, that could become a moment in which the contempt for you is justified to crush you. And end up, you know, if one used that particular strategy in one of the prisons and so forth. Now, of course, prisoners, political prisoners are there for different reasons. Host of different reasons, see. But there were different strategies used. Brother Martin was a political prisoner. Right? Never picked up a gun. He had other kind of weaponry. And our movement is always going to be a multi-strategy movement.
Yes.
It will always be. When I see Brother Malik Zula Shabazz,
yes,
of the New Black Panthers,
yes. Yes.
I sit down and tell the brother, you know what? There's a tradition of what you're doing, brother.
Yes,
you better be aware of that.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why I agree with this and disagree with that. I tell you why I think it's limited and truncated in a certain strategy. I tell you why I love your courage and love for black people. Let's sit down and break bread together.
Yes.
Same is true with another organization. Black nationalists, so and so. We've always had a variety of voices. Our problem has always been we can't create the unity in diversity, in part because we got insecure egos among the leaders. That they're so hungry for recognition and visibility. Everybody wants to be the HNIC, the head Negro in charge. Well, you don't need any HNIC. You need collectivity and respect mediated. That's like saying, well, Miles, How come you got to blow first in your quartet? Hey, Coltrane's taking an hour. I'm blowing for 9 minutes. They call it my quartet, but he's dominating. Why? Because he takes that long for him to express himself. That's cool. That's self-respect in a collectivity. That's what we need. And that's the challenge of our leaders. That's very important. I'm sorry to go on that, but go ahead.
The brother right here with the hat on. Yes.
How you doing, my brother?
All right.
Sure.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the negative focus on what they put the money in, is it like tearing down more schools, tearing down more hospitals, and building up more prisons? Do you think that's the issue with that too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you heard Brother Larry Ham speak to that with real insight. But the thing is, we not only have to make it more visible, we've got to show people the connection between the build up militarism and the cutback in social services. The way in which conservative leadership and rhetoric tries to hide and conceal that. You got Bush talking about don't leave any child behind. Yeah. That was a slogan of the Children's Defense Fund of the great prophetic figure, Marion Wright Edelman. Don't steal her rhetoric and then cut back on services to children. Let's show the hypocrisy of it. You see? Let's show the hypocrisy of it. Running deficits that expand and expand, and just 10 years ago telling Clinton if you had any deficit at all, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Now you got the biggest deficit. And saying it's okay now. For what? For military buildup. If you're gonna have a deficit, let's have a deficit for the children and their education, for health care, for working people and so forth. Yeah, we can run a deficit for that. Why? Because you're investing in people, you're investing in infrastructure, you're investing in the future of the productivity and the quality of the productivity of one's nation, let alone larger public interest and citizenship. We got a little small.
All right.
How can the children help?
Yes, indeed. Appreciate it.
Oh, no.
Because you're so very right, though. When we started off saying that we here, primarily because of the children. We love them so. We love you so. Children help by three things. Trying to do the right thing in light of what the elders tell them if the children can see those elders doing the right thing. See what I mean? So you got to make an assessment. There's going to be some elders who's just a little off at the moment. They're in process. And if they're a little off, then you want to hold off from certain things they might say because they haven't got it all together yet. But then there's other elders who deeply care for you, support you, concerned about you, and want you to do the right thing. So you want to learn how to work hard. You want to learn how to play hard. Very important, young children, learn how to play. Playing is an integral role of being human and learning how to be a mature, compassionate human being. And we got a lot of young folk today who never really played. The cutback in schools begins with what? The arts.
That's right.
Athletics. You can't be a young folk and not play and reach maturity. You end up 25 and want to play. Now it's time to get down to business now. You can go to the club on Friday and Saturday night and see the brothers in midlife crisis, you know, 50 years old, still kind of act like they playing. Hey, it's over now, brother. Hey, you got responsibility. You got three kids at home, brother. You better get back and let them play. I'm sorry, but I'm coming back to your thing. That was number two. You work hard, you play hard. And the third thing is, you want to love hard. This is very important, you see, because people who love you allow you to learn how to love so that you can then love others. Because we got a whole generation of young folk who often have lost the art of love and the art of intimacy because they've never been loved and they've never been treated in an intimate way. You know, Dostoevsky says in The Grand Inquisitor, this is a great novel that published by Dostoevsky, he says, hell is to suffer from the inability to love. You want to love, but you don't know how. We don't want young folk suffering from unable to love. So you receive the love, and then you learn how to love your friends, your sisters, your brothers, and so forth. And you hope in the end, you can extend that love to all of humanity. That's how children make a difference.
Great. I believe that's Tim Gaylord all the way in the back.
Brother Cornell, thank you for coming tonight.
Yeah, it's a blessing to be here. So good to see you. So good to see you, though, brother.
I'd like you to tell us what you think about the Green Party and its role in future role in American politics.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. Definitely. My dear brothers and sisters of all colors in the Greens, and of course, Ralph Nader, who told for me much more of the truth about the dynamics of power in American society than any other presidential candidate. They didn't want him to be part of the debate, you see. Now, a lot of people down on Nader, and down on myself for supporting Nader, because they say, well, actually, if Nader hadn't run, then Gore would have won. And you say, well, you see, Gore didn't carry his own district. So he got some work to do, you know what I mean? His own congressional district. Didn't carry the state of his boss, Bill Clinton. So that you can't simply just look, point fingers at somebody else if somebody's not doing what they ought to do in their own case in that regard. Now, granted, it is a very delicate issue anytime you talk about a third party in America, because America's system has been a two-party system. Both systems are so deeply dominated by corporate interests that it's hard for working people's interests and poor people's interests to surface. But when you get a Green Party, you don't want one of the main parties using that party and undercut another party that may be better than that party. What I mean by that is this, that the Democratic Party does have some progressive voices left. There's no doubt about that. They got a few. We just lost Brother Paul Wellstone, one of the major progressive voices. Major progressive voices. But there's a few left. Republican Party, null set. Null set. You might have some decent folk like Colin, but he's a cog in the American imperial machine at this point. You see. And Condoleezza Rice has always been a deeply conservative, brilliant reactionary system. That's what she's always been. So she uses her skill at the service of the empire and conservative policy. I can celebrate her in terms of she looks like my sister. It is good to have a black woman who's so brilliant, but what are you using it for? That becomes a question. What are you using it for? Well, the Green Party comes along and says, we want to tell the truth, but we want to enter the political arena and therefore have to deal with the dynamics of Republican and Democratic parties. And in the last election, when those of us who went with Ralph Nader, because he was both speaking the truth and because the Democratic Party had so thoroughly disrespected so many working and poor people, you see. And at a certain level, I don't know about you, but I just draw the line in the sand. I say, look, I know I've been dealing with flawed parties. But there's certain things, like talking about my mama, I don't put up with. And there's certain things that are treating poor people, like Clinton signing a welfare bill. A bill that Ronald Reagan wouldn't have signed. Why did you do it, Brother Bill? I don't want to hear your saxophone. Tell me why you did it. To win the election. To steal the thunder from the right wing. Well, you can't steal thunder if you're going to end up with the thunder. With the right wing. With right wing policies against poor people. And then have the black woman up there when you're signing it, reinforcing the white supremacist perception of black women when you're signing the bill. That's disrespectful to black people. And you have to have leaders who are willing to say that. You see what I mean? Now, this next election is different. You got to be jazz-like. You got to be improvisational. Can't be dogmatic. It changes the situation to situation. We'll have to see who wins from out of the primary. Will there be somebody who's speaking to some of the issues that the Green Party wants to speak to? Who will emerge out of the Green Party? The problem of the Green Party has been what? They can't generate substantive black leadership so that the black community that historically is a pillar for progressive politics in America would take the Green Party seriously. You see what I mean? So when me and Brother Ralph traveled all around the country and we ended up the day before the election where? House of Justice, Manhattan, Al Sharpton. Had them sit down together. Said, y'all need to get a chance to know one another. Break a little bread. Ralph Nader hadn't seen so many Negroes in his life in one place. And he's a good brother. He's a progressive brother. But he just hadn't been in that chocolate that saturated his face. That's all. And Sharpton needed to engage with the Greens. We all can learn from one another. You see, Al Sharpton is always open. He's growing. He's developing. He needs to learn something from the Greens. Greens need to learn something from him in this regard. So I actually like to be a mediator. You know what I mean? And spending time with both of them in terms of trying to push and be pushed myself.
Back to the balcony.
Glad to see you in person.
Blessing to meet you.
I'd like to ask you how you would solve this problem.
Hmm.
In the paper, the Star Ledger, this week I think it was, it gave a listing that people rented apartments for $9,987 to two of the apartments. They would have to work 144 hours a week at $5.50 an hour. Doesn't that relate to us? How in the devil can we manage our lives, the younger children that's coming up?
Yes.
And then we're going to go work at McDonald's.
Exactly.
Baby has got a baby. Child care, insurance. How in the devil can she work at McDonald's and take care of that?
Yeah. No, it's a very important question though, brother. Very important question. And it has much to do with the point I was making about not enough jobs with a living wage. And not enough jobs with a living wage because in part the bargaining power of labor has lessened owing to the power of the bosses. Labor itself needs to be more creative and bring new folk in, especially being open to the new immigrants. And this is a problem that black folk have to come to terms with. That the black and brown divide is a shame. It's sad. It's fighting for crumbs. It's fighting for crumbs. We need progressive brown leadership, progressive black leadership to build bridges between these two communities. Very important. But that's connected to the labor movement and the attempt to ensure that we can create more jobs that produce wages such that 50 and 60% of one's check does not have to go to rent. But then we also have to deal with the housing problem. And that's market driven, right? People are making big money by keeping these prices up, driving poor people out, allowing middle class youth to come in, gentrifying the cities, and therefore undergoing another wave of urban renewal. In which what? In which poor people, working people, become invisible again. Right? Just like the homeless in New York City. People walk around, oh, it's just so nice that we don't see any homeless no more. Well, where do you think they went? They're human beings. What happened to them? You think they just disappeared? A lot of them did come to Jersey. Just came right across through the tunnel. You know? So that the issue that you raise is a difficult one because it's not just a matter of individuals. You have to think again as organizations and collectivities, as groups bringing power to bear to try to ensure that there's policy such that there's jobs with a living wage. Because what you talk about is so real, so concrete.
I hear Wilbur Carnegie. Go ahead, Wilbur.
There are one fight that the globalization and progress has been fighting for living wage in cooperation with the Clintonville South Board Food Association.
Wonderful.
We are now involved in a prolonged struggle, and I'm glad that Senator Muir Hill related to it. Because it's a funny thing, the governor of New Jersey, McGreevy, who received large support from the black community and the brown community and poor folks in general in New Jersey, he finds it to listen to the U.S. Supreme Court as it relates to set-asides to abolish them under a black face. You know, they give us a black face for something that's against us, Peter Harper.
Right.
But
right,
I'm saying,
right.
Hold him accountable also.
Absolutely.
But the thing of it is, but he chooses not to listen to the state Supreme Court that says you must fund special needs New Jersey educational districts at a certain rate. That he wants to slash. That he wants to, through McGinnis, the assistant education commissioner, he wants to say black and urban districts have enough money, they just must have to spend it more wisely. I'm saying that we should protest being threatened with the Clinton Hill Improvement Association in cooperation with FOP. We'll be leading demonstrations in Trenton to protest this policy of Peter Harvey and Edward Green, because these are real urban. There's $301 million spent on state construction corporation projects, a school construction, and now in the city of New York, now one black construction.
Right.
My question, it seems the majority, President, yourself excluded, it seems that the majority of academics and intellectuals who have sort of retreated to the ivory tower refuse to actually get into the trench work and be events like this and actually show solidarity with regular working people to facilitate change. How can we as activists bring analytical, reason-based people into our movements so that when, instead of being labeled leftist,
right,
not all for media, we can present a public face that shows that we have serious platforms for change and that we want to articulate our concerns to get our message out to more people?
Yeah.
No.
Appreciate the question, though, brother. It's a very important question. One of the points I was making about this brother right here, Brother Dr. Gunther, is that he brings together the life of the mind and the world of ideas with activism on the ground. And he's one in this area who's just legendary. He's been there 30 years, over 30 years doing that. That's a long time to be on the battlefield in the academy and both. But you're right. Now, what part of the problem is, you see, is that so many academics of a conservative bent are in some ways in the streets. It's just they're in the streets through their connections in the White House, the courts, and so forth. So their effects are felt on the ground because they're shaping public policy. But they don't have to go to these kind of meetings because they're doing it behind closed doors. But they're still very involved. Now, the irony is that people look at me and say, well, you're politically involved. And those folk are more politically involved than I am. They have more impact. But it's done very quietly with their networks, shaping the public policy, using their ideas to generate public policy that are in opposition to what we are fighting for in this regard. So your point's a good one. For me, there's a sense in which all of us are always already involved, see. Not to choose is itself a choice.
Yeah.
If you think you ivory tower, then neutrality means that you actually are attenuating movement. You're getting in the way. Somebody else trying to get through. Well, I'm neutral. Well, get out of the way. Being neutral is a stand. See what I mean? It's like during the 1960s. What do you think about American apartheid? I'm neutral on the issue. Well, it's clear that you're not helping out. You see, it's your neutrality that has kept the silence in place that justifies the denial such that folks still catching hell. So the neutrality translates into a certain kind of partisanship. That's what I'm saying in part. And so I think, but the other thing to keep in mind is we have to support our progressive institutions in our means of communication. That's why when people mention WBAI.
Yes.
The Nation Magazine. The Final Call. The Agitator. All of those different things. Labor movement has its networks of information, newsletters, and so forth. Very important. And you try to gain access through those very contexts. The loony ones are those who don't want to be fashionable. They don't want to be indifferent to other people's suffering. So when they're called loony, you say, thank you so very much. You got my point. I refuse to conform to the fashion of being indifferent to other people's suffering. I'm going to cut against the fashion. Call me loony or whatever. I'm with you, bro.
One last question. This is the last question. In the back, the white shirt. City Councilman John Sowell, President of City Council of Irving. Give him a hand. Yes.
Thank you, first and foremost. What I'm learning more and more as I travel through life and interact with folks is this miseducation of our people. And I read Carl Houston's book over the summer a second time. And we're beginning to address miseducation, we're really selling ourselves short. And that's not looking at our institutions for higher learning. When you think you have some education for our public school systems, then you go to get miseducated, they come back thinking like the enemy. I'm running for more and more of that.
All right, very good, John.
So it's this 25-40-year-old group is still miseducated. It's frustrating trying to dialogue with them. And we have to address that. I just want to know your feeling on that as a professor, as a scholar.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question, brother, and I just pay tribute to your work, though, man. And you look so young, though. You put in those years already, huh?
Yeah, I know.
That's all right. You got a secret to your preservative project here. No, first thing I think is that the notion of paideia, which is the formation of attention and the cultivation of a self. See, the problem of a lot of the young folk is not just that they're miseducated, but their curiosity has not been piqued. Their sense of perplexity has not been accented. So they sleepwalk. Well, you see, there's a step prior to being educated. And that is having your hunger and your thirst stirred up enough so that certain questions are asked that are relevant enough for you to want to pursue knowledge and wisdom.
Yes, yes.
And it's that pre-reflective moment prior to handing out the books, telling them about Black history, telling them about so-and-so. If they're not, their curiosity is not piqued, you can talk about that all day. Doesn't make any difference. See what I mean? And so that's why I talk about care, what Heidegger calls sorge. Care is that in which they feel invested enough to be unsettled, to then be open to serious education. You see, what happened in the 1960s was you had courageous folk out there, disproportionately Black, but of all colors.
Yes, yes.
They were dying, so people raising questions. What are these people out there getting shot like dogs for? That raises questions. Curiosity emerges. Perplexity flows. Then people have to raise, how do we answer these questions? Knowledge. How do we respond to wisdom and so forth, you see? So the issue that you are raising about young folk and miseducation is an important one, but I think we have to deal with this earlier one of trying to shake them. Now the question then becomes, where is the shaking taking place? I mean, one of the reasons why I spend so much time both in the library and in the studio now. You know, with my first CD, Sketches of My Culture, we just did a double CD this summer that's coming out in January, Sketches 2. We got a whole discussion on the B word in hip hop, whole discussion on the N word in hip hop, whole discussion on conception of women in hip hop, whole conception on labor in hip hop. Why? Because those artists are unsettling them. They'll move from the classroom and go listen to the music and be unsettled and act as if there's no relation between the two. Well, a serious educator knows you've got to have enough respect for their world to get them unsettled so that they end up wanting to read W.B. Du Bois, wanting to read Carter Woodson, wanting to read Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham and so forth, so that that miseducation that you and Carter Woodson talk about becomes available in a way such that it is something that's vital in their lives. Is something that's relevant in their lives, the way in which the music is relevant. See, one of the problems I think of educators, of young people, and this is true for intellectuals as a whole, back to the other brother's question, is that there's a sense in American society that educators and intellectuals are just appendages to the market. You see, so you educate to give them a skill so that they can gain access to a job to live large in some vanilla suburb. And you say, no, no, no. They need a skill, yes, but that's not paideia. That's not a deep education. That's schooling. There's a difference. Schooling and education, not the same thing at all. One of the reasons why I spend time in the prison, connected to prison ministry, is what? A lot of those brothers, they only let me see the brothers, they let me see the sisters, for a number of reasons, won't go into it at the moment, but only the brothers, right? That there's great intelligence and creativity and imagination in those prisons. They can be educated without them being schooled. Like Malcolm.
That's right.
James Baldwin never went to college. The college went through him. Mm. The finest essayist in the language of Shakespeare and Milton of the 20th century, born in Harlem, USA, never set foot in a college. He educated himself. He had a formation of attention. He had a cultivation of himself to tell the truth and to keep the love flowing. Well, you see, I am as interested in the Malcolms and James Baldwins as I am in those who are at the Rutgers and Princeton. And I think it's a wonderful thing to be at Rutgers and Princeton. Don't get me wrong. But that's the first step. There's got to be some follow through. Knowledge for what? Just for you and your individual career as project? Or is it knowledge for you and the community? How do you situate yourself in relation to a tradition that came before? How do you locate yourself in relation to freedom fighters who came before? Well, I don't know. That's that miseducation you talking about. You see. And then you'd be related in their own individual world. Because if they don't recognize Marcus Garvey, they don't recognize a Martin Luther King or whatever, you say, well, what do you think Dead Prayers in Common are about? What do you think Mos Def is about? What do you think Chuck D was about in the 80s? What do you think KRS-One was about? What do you think Lauryn Hill was about? They understand their relation to the tradition. They're just expressing it musically. NDIRE, what do you think she's about? It's not that far from your world. Check out your world, brother and sister. We love you so such that in your own world, there are remnants and relics of the tradition I'm talking about if you listen close enough. That's part of the education we're talking about. You all take good care and stay strong in your work, brother.
Showing our appreciation. Dr. Cornel West.